Okay, I think this is recording, so I'm not exactly sure. Okay, so this is about 2:31, and it's March 26th, and we're going to finish up central nervous system today and move into peripheral nervous system. Does anybody have any questions over what we've been going over so far? Still got to finish a couple things up. Any announcements from SI? No? Just the usual stuff? Okay. That's good. Okay, sign-in sheet. It's right here. Please make sure you sign the sign-in sheet. Okay, so last time we looked at the brainstem, and you should know the pieces of the brainstem, including the schedule. Let's look at the schedule first. That's why I have it here. All right, so we said today's the 26th. Yeah, we'll get into peripheral nervous system. That's chapter 14. And there's practicums this week. And so we're not going to have practicums April 7th and 9th. We're going to have those practicums right after spring break. Spring break is the 14th and 16th. All right, so on the 21st and 23rd, we're going to have practicum 3. And in the in lab, you can find out what labs those are. I think it's 7, 8, and 10, 7, 8, and 10 for lab practicum 3. Also, right after spring break on that Monday, the 21st, we have our third exam over 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, and 17. Right, so be aware that both Monday labs have the lab practicum and a lecture test on the same day. And then the very last week of the semester, which is coming up pretty fast, it's the Wednesday group that gets the lecture exam and a practicum on the same day. And then you can tell me if it's efficient to do that or not. And maybe I would just schedule that from now on more often. Because some students say, well, they get to study one time and take two tests. And sometimes they like that. I don't know. You can let me know. Any questions on the schedule? I don't think so. Okay. What happened to my figures? Ah, it's right there. Okay, so central nervous system. What the heck is the central nervous system? What are the two main pieces of the central nervous system? Brain and spinal cord. We haven't talked about the spinal cord at all, but we've been talking about the brain, starting with the brain stem, moving up into the diencephalon, and then up to the cerebrum. So what pieces of the brain stem did we talk about? We talked about the medulla. You should know some functions of that. The pons, which is right above that. And then the midbrain, which is right above that. And superior inferior colliculus are part of the midbrain. And you should know some functions of those two things. And, there was something that I forgot to mention about the midbrain. I'm glad we're going over this. We talked about that canal for cerebral spinal fluid, the aqueduct of Sylvius, or sometimes that we call that the cerebral aqueduct. But what did I forget? Okay, this is what I forgot. All right, so here's a picture of a real brain. So spinal cord is about here. I see a first little bump. It's a little subtle, but there's a bump here. That is the medulla. The second bump is the pons. All right, and then here is the midbrain, including the corpora quadrigemina, superior and inferior colliculus. Here's that aqueduct of Sylvius between ventricles. This is a third ventricle and fourth ventricle. What I didn't mention was this tissue right here. This is a major bridge between the brain stem and the diencephalon and the cerebrum. This is a bridge, a big, huge bridge. It connects those major parts of the brain. And I've maybe kind of talked about these things in general because here is a connection between the pons and the cerebellum. Anybody remember what I called this thing? It's a really weird word. The connection between the pons. Because the pons, remember, partly is a relay station for sending signals into the cerebellum. All right, so there's got to be a bridge between the pons and the cerebellum. And that's what we call a peduncle. A peduncle is a major bridge between different parts of the brain. And so this one, going to the cerebellum, we're going to call that the cerebellar peduncle. And as a matter of fact, there's three of them. But think of that as a bridge. All right. And so this over here, I said, was a bridge. between the brainstem and the cerebrum. All right, so, and what do we call a bridge? This bridge in anatomy? A peduncle. All right, so here's another peduncle. But this is not the cerebellar peduncle, right, because it's taking information up to the cerebrum, so these are the cerebral peduncles. Right, cerebellar peduncles here, cerebral peduncles. So that really makes the midbrain. The cerebral peduncles, aqueducta sylvius, and the corpora quadrigemina. Okay. So, good. I'm glad I went back over that. Cerebrum. So we were talking about different parts of the cerebrum. And you're aware of the frontal lobe, parietal lobe, occipital lobe, and I can see a little bit of which lobe right here. Which one is this right here? Okay, here's frontal. And then here's parietal. And here's occipital. Cerebellum is not part of the cerebrum, but I see another part right here. What is that? I can only see the tip of it. I can only see a little bit. That is the temporal lobe. Okay, so when I get to another picture, I'll show you where that is. So if you want to think of the major function of the frontal lobe, what did we talk about? And I forgot to mention how you can remember it easily. The frontal lobe is the primary somatomotor cortex. Right? This is the part of the brain that controls skeletal muscle. And how can you remember that the frontal cortex controls motor activity in your body? Well, you have a car. And where do you have the motor in your car? At least most of you. And the front, right? So think of that. That might remind you. The motor cortex is in the frontal lobe. Okay, who has a motor in the back of their car? Anybody have a motor in the back of their car here? Huh? Nobody? Nobody, nobody, nobody? Oh, well, good. That's a really good example. Anybody have a motor right in the middle of their car? Raise your hand. No? I would want to get to know you if you did, but since nobody has, then that's the way it goes. Just show up to class. I won't bug you to drive your car. Okay, so the motor is in the front. Same thing for the frontal lobe in the brain. And Broca's area, that's a motor area specifically for speech. And we looked at that homuncular diagram last time, and the precentral gyrus is part of the frontal lobe. It's that first gyrus right in front of the central sulcus. And I think maybe we got to basal ganglia. Okay, basal ganglia. Now, you got to go back to the previous chapter and for sure know what a ganglion is and what a nucleus is and what white matter is and gray matter and all that kind of stuff. Right? And I said last time that the basal ganglia is some old nomenclature that our book hasn't caught up with yet. The basal ganglia really are basal nuclei because they're gray matter deep inside the nervous system. And I see them right here. All right, so we're in the frontal lobe in this region. And, of course, it probably doesn't look gray. Maybe it looks gray, maybe not, but it kind of looks blue or purple or something to me. But certainly not white. All right, so these are groups of nerve cell bodies and dendrites. And here is some white matter. So I have tracts going between these nuclei. The basal nuclei, or what your book calls basal ganglia, these are all involved with coordinating muscles, skeletal muscle in your body. And when there's degeneration of the basal nuclei, then people have motor problems, right? Like Parkinson's disease, for instance. All right, so I do want you to know that. What else do we see right here? We see some of the ventricles, but this right here, this is part of the diencephalon. This is the thalamus. And you got to remember what the job of the thalamus is. Can anybody remember what the job of the thalamus is? It's not a basal nucleus. It's just a part of the diencephalon. All this other stuff is in the cerebrum. But the thalamus is kind of like the pons in that it is a relay station, right? So sensory information has to go to the thalamus, and then the thalamus directs it to the proper lobe for your appreciation. So if it is visual information, the thalamus directs those signals to the occipital lobe. That is the job of the occipital lobe. If it is sensory, If it's auditory, it sends it over to the temporal lobe, and then you have the perception of sound. Okay, so occipital for vision, temporal for hearing. And parietal lobe, right, is just for somatosensory, sensation on the surface of your body, like touch, pressure, pain, temperature, in the post-central gyrus. Right. And just like there's an area in the frontal lobe that controls speech, at least the motor aspects of speech, there's an area in the occipital lobe, right, that we call Wernicke's area. This is for comprehension of speech. So if there's damage to this area, then somebody will be able to speak, right, but they won't be able to maybe even understand what they're saying, or if they hear somebody talking, they won't be able to understand language. So when there are certain lesions in the brain that can produce pretty weird kinds of syndromes for people. Right, that Wernicke's area is in the occipital lobe. So some of these areas, this is not an exam figure. But nonetheless, it's still a pretty good illustration of where some of these areas are. Aha. Okay, so we can go over the lobes. There's a temporal lobe, occipital lobe, frontal lobe. Central sulcus separates the parietal lobe from the frontal. This first gyrus right in front of the central sulcus, of course you call that the precentral gyrus. That is for motor. Right? So this is the control skeletal muscle in your body. And corresponding right across the central sulcus, this is for sensation. And so if there's an area right here that controls motor function of your leg, if we hop right across the central sulcus and stimulate this area right here, what's going to happen? Is your other leg going to move? Remember, this is motor for leg. If we stimulate this area here, is that going to make the other leg move? Or what's going to happen? This is what? The sensory cortex, somatosensory cortex. Then somebody will have a sensation on that same leg. All right, so this is motor. Over here is sensory. And it maps out according to the surface of your body. Okay. And here you can see Broca's area right here, and here is Wernicke's area, this whole area right here. And Wernicke's area is kind of between the auditory cortex, which is in the temporal lobe, and the visual cortex. And when we understand language, we actually like to use both of those senses. We like to hear what somebody is saying, and we like to see what their facial expression is and how they're saying words. Right, and so the Wernicke's area is kind of like right between the visual areas and the auditory areas. So this right here, we call this the primary auditory cortex. Here's the primary visual cortex, right? And then there are association areas that are close to these various cortices that integrate information up to make sense of what we see visually. Right, so if the primary visual cortex is functioning without the association areas, then you might not be able to recognize certain kinds of patterns. You might just see flashes of light or certain kinds of colors, right, without any kind of definition. Then the primary visual cortex sends that information to the association areas. The association areas then make sense out of what those visual signals are, right? So if you see a black and white pattern, the primary auditory cortex couldn't tell that it's a letter or a word, but the association areas can, because they're getting information from this primary visual cortex. So that's the job of these higher areas. Same thing for the auditory cortex as well. Like the primary auditory cortex, you might be able to appreciate like noises or a sound, but you won't be able to appreciate, for instance, music, unless this association area is there. Right, to understand a difference between tones and rhythmicity and all of that kind of stuff happens within an association area. Okay. White matter. What the heck is white matter once again? Somebody should tell me what white matter is. Yeah, it's myelinated axons, right? That are going someplace. And since we're talking about central nervous system, then these are going to be tracts. And we have maybe three general kinds of tracts in our body. And I see one kind of tract right here. Here is that thalamus. And remember I said the thalamus is a relay station for sensory information, and then the thalamus sends these signals to the proper parts of the cerebral cortex, right? So we call these projection fibers because they're projecting from an inferior part of the central nervous system to a superior part, or maybe from a superior part down to an inferior part. And it kind of just looks like sun rays right here. These are projection fibers. Other kinds of fibers that we have. Okay, association and commissural fibers. Rats, I just saw these. Okay, so here's the brain, here's a section through the brain, and let's remember, what kind of section is this? Okay, I don't think I would like to say sagittal. I would like to say frontal or coronal, right? So this is separating an anterior from a posterior part of the brain, and so we're going to look at the brain right at this section. So here's the superior part. This is the cerebrum up over here. Here's the cerebellum. Here's the brain stem. And these lines represent tracts. So we see some tracts that are moving from inferior to superior or superior to inferior. These are what we call projection tracts. And notice, where are these tracts located in this region right here? Yeah, that's what I wanted to show you. Very nice. We see these tracts within the white matter, not the gray matter, right? So tracts are really indeed white matter. And this white matter between the basal nuclei is what we call the internal capsule. So the internal capsule is for projection fibers connecting superior and inferior parts of the brain. All right, we see some other kinds of tracts. I see some tracts that start in one gyrus and move over to another gyrus. And these don't change sides in the brain. They stay on the same side of the brain. All right? And these are what we're going to call association fibers. So here is a fiber that takes information from this gyrus, past this sulcus, into a neighboring gyrus. What kind of fiber do we want to call this? Okay. And would that be a projection? No, because it doesn't go really from superior to inferior. It goes from one gyrus to another. So this is what we call association tracts. These are association tracts. And we know it's a tract because what can you tell me about this area where the cursor is moving around? It's white matter, right. Okay. Well, the last one that I didn't show you is there are tracts that move from one hemisphere, the left hemisphere, over to the right, or from the right to the left. And I see some right here. And these are what we call commissural tracts. And again, if you look in this behind the tract, you'll see that it's white matter. And this thing right here is a big connection between the right and left sides of the brain. We're going to call this the corpus callosum. is really easy to see on a sagittal section. All right, so we got corpus callosum for commissural fibers, internal capsule for projection fibers, and then all of this white matter here for association fibers, right? And in particular, what? Myelinated axons. All right, so what else do I see in this diagram? Well, right smack on midline, I do see a ventricle connected to some other ventricles. This contains cerebrospinal fluid that we're going to look at in just a second. And then here is the thalamus. And here you can see the thalamus projecting fibers up to various parts of the cerebral cortex. Cerebellum. All right, so here I see the cerebellum. What should we know about the cerebellum? Make sure you know where it is. And there's one other thing. There's a pattern that I want you to be able to observe within the cerebellum. Okay, so here's a photograph of a real brain, and I can see white matter, and I can see gray matter. And there are a lot of convolutions within the cerebellum. And this pattern that white matter makes up against gray matter, we call that arbor vitae, because that means tree of life. If somebody has well-defined white matter and well-defined gray matter, then chances are this cerebellum is very, very healthy, will be able to do its job. But if this pattern is lost, then somebody's going to have trouble with what kinds of activities? Well, motor control. So the cerebellum is important not for initiating action of skeletal muscles, but for instance, if you're walking and then all of a sudden trip on the sidewalk, the cerebellum is aware that muscles aren't behaving properly, and it's going to make very quick adjustments so that you don't fall down. So it's getting information from all the muscles in your body in terms of the tension that they're producing and angulation of joints and body position. And it has an idea of what your body position should be and where it's going, and if there's an error between what it is doing compared to what it should be doing, then the cerebellum can make corrections for that. All right, so it controls balance and coordination of complex motor movements for skeletal muscle. Okay, so that's pretty much the brain, a good introduction to the brain. And let's look at the spinal cord. So where is the spinal cord located? Well, below the brain stem. All right, so here is the spinal cord. Spinal cord exists between C1 and down to about the level of L2, and there it stops. So here is the vertebral canal made up of all those vertebral foramina just lined up. And after L2, we just see a bunch of nerves that move down through the vertebral canal and then finally exit through a foramen, maybe an intervertebral foramen or an anterior or posterior sacral foramen. All right, so there's no spinal cord in this area here, but there is above L2. And you might notice that the width of the spinal cord is not the same. I see it's a little bit thicker in the cervical region, it's a little bit thicker in the lumbar region, and it's kind of thin in the thoracic region. Can anybody imagine why is there more spinal cord in this region, the cervical enlargement and the lumbar enlargement, but not in this thoracic region? What do you think is happening here and here? You have a lot of nerves right there. This is true. You have a lot of nerves in the cervical enlargement and the lumbar enlargement, not so many in this thoracic region, because connected to those regions are your appendages, right? Cervical region does connect or does send impulses. It communicates with your upper appendage. The lumbar enlargement communicates with your lower appendage that I see right here. Okay. And there are a lot of reflexes. There are a lot of body motions that the spinal cord automatically takes care of for you that you don't have to think about consciously. For instance, if you grab something hot with your hand, that those pain fibers will send information into the central nervous system. How does a signal get into the central nervous system? What kind of pathway is that? Sensory, and you should know that to be afferent. That's an afferent pathway. And it's a damaging stimulus. There are association fibers or direct connections to motor fibers that once that pain signal gets into the spinal cord, it stimulates the motor neurons to a skeletal muscle to contract so that you withdraw your hand from that damaging stimulus. All right, so that reflex activity just requires a spinal cord, and that happens before the signal even goes up to the thalamus and to the cerebral cortex for your appreciation. All right, so you can't consciously think with the spinal cord, but it is always looking at everything in your body, trying to sense inappropriate positions and damaging stimulus. So there are reflexes, and there are many more reflexes involving arms and legs than there are, for instance, for your lungs and your heart and thymus. Right? Those mostly are just visceral organs, but you have somatic organs controlled by the cervical enlargement and lumbar enlargement. But don't forget, spinal cord is central nervous system, okay? So that reflex does involve the central nervous system, just not the brain. And you can't appreciate anything that's happening inside your spinal cord, except if you maybe look at your body, you understand maybe some levels where things are happening. But where do you have the appreciation of sound, for instance? Where's that? Or the appreciation of pain? It's in the cerebral cortex. So where you have the sense of sound is in the temporal lobe. And where you have the appreciation of visual signals is in, not the spinal cord, but the occipital lobe. Right, occipital lobe. And as far as pain on the surface of your body, which is what we're talking about, you should now know where you have that sensation, appreciation of that damaging stimulus. Where is that at? It's on the surface of your body, that somatic region on your body. Is it the precentral gyrus or the postcentral gyrus? Post, that's right, because the precentral is motor. Yeah, okay. And so that painful stimulus is going to go up to the postcentral gyrus. You'll be able to appreciate it, but by that time, the spinal cord has already made a decision for you on what to do. And it might be to withdraw the arm that is being damaged and maybe extend the other one to push you away from that stimulus, right? So there can be a lot of coordinated motions that are taken care of just by the spinal cord. Okay, so while we were talking about that, you could see that I zoomed into a region right here. And so this is where I have the cursor now. I see kind of like the tip of the spinal cord, kind of looks like a cone. And we call that the conus medullaris. That's something that will be important for you to know, the conus medullaris. And then inferior to the conus medullaris, we don't have a spinal cord anymore. They're just spinal nerves that are going through the vertebral foramen. Surrounding the spinal cord, we have cerebrospinal fluid. There's fluid in these areas. And you could probably tell me what color that is. Is it gray area? I don't know. What color is this right here? Purple. Okay, so you got gold and purple. The purple is fluid. The gold part is the spinal cord, and then some nerves that are leaving the spinal cord. And if you ever get an infection of the central nervous system, of course, that could be very deadly in a very short period of time, whether it's a viral infection, bacterial infection, fungal infection. And what would we call that class of infection? Meningitis. Yeah, meningitis. Because there are membranes that surround the brain and spinal cord that we call the meninges, and we're going to look at that in just a second. And when those get infected and inflamed, okay, we call that meningitis. And if it involves the brain, sometimes we call that encephalitis, right? And both of those can be really deadly. So sometimes we might want to actually get some that central nervous system tissue and analyze it for bacteria, and maybe run a panel of viruses and maybe try to identify a fungus or something. All right, but we don't want to rip any of these neurons out, do we? Because you use all that nervous tissue. But there's something that we can withdraw from these areas of the central nervous system, and that is cerebrospinal fluid. All right, sometimes we call that a lumbar tap, because where would you like to puncture, right, the meninges to get some of that cerebrospinal fluid? not above the conus medullaris, because you could lacerate part of the spinal cord. All right, so, and then down below the conus medullaris, there's plenty of cerebral spinal fluid for investigating, right? But there's no longer any spinal cord. So the spinal tap is performed in one of these regions right here, and when a needle is inserted, right, it's rare that these nerves get damaged. They kind of just get pushed out of the way, as opposed to the spinal cord that would be punctured. All right, and then that cerebral spinal fluid is aspirated out with a syringe, and then it can be analyzed. All right, so that's the importance of knowing where this conus medullaris is. When we have all these spinal nerves coursing down from the conus medullaris, it reminded somebody of a tail on a horse. It reminded somebody these all look like horse hairs dangling down. And so it was named the cauda equina. Cauda means tail. Equina means horse, horse's tail. Right? And so these are all just spinal nerves. There's one last thing that's important that you should see. There's a dark filament that runs right smack down the middle. Can you see this dark filament right here? It's not quite neuronal tissue. It's more like a ligament, and it's attached to the tip of the conus medullaris down near the sacrum, and it puts a little traction on the spinal cord. And that's important, because without that traction, then the spinal cord might actually retract back up into the brain, right? And it could damage all these nerves that are coming out of it. All right, and that is called the phylum terminale. Phylum terminale is this central, almost, it's not a ligament, but you could consider this a ligament, right, that keeps the spinal cord in the proper location. Okay, the other thing that you notice is, how come we don't have spinal cord all the way down in these lumbar regions? How come there's just a space with spinal nerves going through there? And that's because during development, after you're born, the vertebral column grows faster than the spinal cord, right? And so you're just left with a little residual volume right here. There can be a problem with that associated with the phylum terminale. For instance, if the tip of the conus medullaris adheres to the sacrum, right, because the phylum terminale really isn't doing its job, or there's some connective tissue that's misplaced, right? What happens when this individual starts to grow rapidly, or when the vertebral column starts to grow rapidly and the conus medullaris is attached to the sacrum? Then it's going to stretch the spinal cord out and damage the spinal cord. And we call that a tethered cord. A tethered cord is when the conus medullaris is attached down to the sacrum. Right, so that phylum terminale also allows for rapid development of the vertebral column without damage to the spinal cord. All right, so that's just some general aspects of the spinal cord. So we say it extends from foramen magnum to second lumbar. There's gray matter and white matter in the spinal cord, just like in the brain. And what do we want to consider this white matter in the spinal cord? What is white matter in the spinal cord? What part of the neuron is that? It's going to be an axon, right? And what kind of axon? Yeah, myelinated axon. And remember, axons are the sending part of a neuron, so those axons are sending information. And that information can enter the spinal cord and go up to the brain, or some of that white matter can take information from the brain down into the spinal cord. And we have to, and since it's white matter, we're going to call those tracts, because it's inside the central nervous system. So what do we call tracts that are ascending, that are going up to the brain? It's one of two things. Okay? They're ascending tracts. Yep, it's an ascending tract. But I want to know what the function of that ascending tract is. It is sensory, yes. Sensory or afferent. Ascending tracts are sensory, and that means then that descending tracts are motor or efferent. All right? And they're going to be in certain kinds of locations. One good way to sort of think about that is think of the architecture of the cerebrum. What is the motor part of the cerebrum? Is it anterior or posterior part? Yeah, anterior, just like your car. Right, so the tracts that are anterior in the spinal cord mostly are motor. Tracts in the posterior spinal cord mostly are our afferent, our sensory. That's not always the case, but it lines up pretty much just like that. All right, so let's look at some of that gray matter and white matter in the spinal cord. Right, this is probably a pretty good view. So, I see a nice vertebrae right here. What kind of vertebrae? What kind of vertebra is this? Yeah, I see some transversus stuff going on. Ah, cervical, because of the transverse foramina. All right, nice bifid spinous process. One of you still have to take a practicum on that kind of vertebrae. And here inside the vertebral canal, I can see the spinal cord. And I can see some gray matter. Now, this is different than in the cerebrum. Gray matter was superficial, but in the spinal cord, gray matter is deep. And the superficial part, or these tracts right here, is white matter. Okay, and this is a pretty common feature when we look at the spinal cord. We call these horns. Right? And these places where there are tracts either going up or down, sometimes we call these funiculi, or one would be a funiculus, or we could call it a column of axons, moving up or moving down. And here I see a pathway that's connecting the right and left parts of the gray matter in the spinal cord. So what connects right to left in the central nervous system? With one word, would you want to say projection? Would you want to say association? You want to say commissural. Yeah, so here's a commissural pathway so that information can move from one side of the spinal cord to the other. For instance, if there's a reflex where you want to withdraw one arm from a damaging stimulus and push away with the other, then the different sides of your central nervous system do have to communicate with each other for that particular purpose. All right, I see some membranes around the spinal cord. And I think I'm just going to describe them around the brain and not the spinal cord, but there are three of them, and there's some fluid between different parts. Right? So when I get back up to the brain, we'll talk about that. Well, actually, there's something I do want to talk about on this slide. This is a nice slide. So the most superficial layer of the meninges, or that membrane that surrounds the brain and spinal cord, is the toughest one. And you can see that it's very thick, right? And we're going to call that the dura mater. That means what? Very durable. It's a very thick, durable kind of membrane that surrounds the whole central nervous system, brain and spinal cord. Okay, then superficial to that, or on top of that, right, is what? What do we call the part of your body that's on top of the dermis? Epidermis, right? So epi means on top of. Here is a space that is on top of, right, or superficial to the dura mater, and it's a space, and there's some lipid in this space, and we call this the epidural space because it is on top of the dura mater. And this is a very nice place where we can inject anesthetics, and that anesthesia then will block nerve conduction just in this local area, just in these nerves that are leaving the spinal cord within this region. And that anesthesia won't go everywhere in the body because anesthesia, of course, can be very dangerous. And it has side effects, right? But an epidural is one way to really reduce all the side effects and any of the damaging things that can be done with it, right? And so typically, what do we call that when somebody gets anesthesia into this epidural space? Well, we just call that an epidural, right? Okay. But you should know about this space right here. And that anesthetic then can diffuse out and deaden these nerves. All right, so when I look at the spinal cord right here, I see some nerves that are posterior, some nerves that are anterior. And these are the only pathways where nerves can enter and leave the spinal cord. And so we like to call these things roots. And so this one back over here, we're going to call the, take a guess. What's the one that's posterior here? You could say posterior root, but most people use the other word. They call this the dorsal root. Right? And if this is the dorsal root, which one is this? That's the ventral, because the body of a vertebrae, of course, is anterior. Can you remember that skeleton in lab? Right? So here's the ventral root. Here's the dorsal root. And remember, in a neuron, which way can information go? In one direction or both directions? One direction, this is true. Okay, and the nerves in a root are all oriented in one direction. So you might have thousands of nerves in this root, but information only goes in one direction. The same thing for this root over here. All the nerves are oriented in one direction, so information only goes in one direction. All right, so this is anterior, and what is your hunch for an anterior part of the spinal cord or anterior part of the brain? Is it mostly motor or sensory? It's mostly motor, right? So here this ventral root is what we call is 100% motor or 100% efferent. The dorsal root, right, is 100% sensory or afferent. So signals enter the spinal cord with the dorsal root and signals leave the spinal cord via the ventral root right here. And that's kind of easy to remember if you remember the architecture of the brain, but you could also remember it because there's a nice big S in sensory and there's a nice big S in what? Dorsal. Okay? And there's a nice big T in ventral and there's a nice big T in motor. Right? And so that could help you remember at least for a couple of weeks until you take the test, but don't forget about that. Okay, connected to the dorsal root, which is what? What kind of root is that again? Is that afferent or efferent, this dorsal root? It is afferent, right? It's sensory. Here is a bulge. Here is a group of all of those nerve cell bodies for a neuron, right? And for neurons that have a shape of those pseudo-unipolar shapes. Right, so the peripheral process goes out through this spinal nerve, the central process enters the spinal cord, and so what do we call a group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites in the peripheral nervous system? This is no longer in the spinal cord, it's left the spinal cord. What do we call like gray matter in the peripheral nervous system? Ganglion, right? What do we call that area of gray matter in the central nervous system? Nucleus, yeah, we should do that. Even though your book sort of has it a little bit backwards. But here's a ganglion. So here's a group of nerve cell bodies of those pseudo-unipolar neurons. We call this the dorsal root ganglion. And that is what? 100% sensory. That's why we said those pseudo-unipolar neurons were afferent shapes. Because this is where they fit in. Okay, let's look at just a little bit more detail we see here in the spinal cord. So again, I see gray matter and white matter. And now I can see the different layers of the meninges. The most superficial one is the strongest one. We call that the dura mater. Then underneath it, there's a little bit weaker membrane. We call that the arachnoid membrane. And then covering every little surface, every convolution, every little dip within on the surface of the spinal cord, and even the brain, every convolution on the brain, there's a very delicate part of the meninges, the third membrane, and we call that the pia mater. Right, so pia mater we're going to look at in lab when we do our dissection, and it's going to be like tissue paper, very, very thin. You can actually look right through it. Can't look through the dura mater, it's way too thick. And most of the brains that we're going to be working on the dura mater, I hope is already removed because it's really hard to remove because it's so tough. It's almost impossible to cut even with a scissors. Right, and you can imagine if you're taking this tough covering off, then there's a lot of damage to the brain and spinal cord, and then you don't have any specimens in lab to look at. Okay, so you got dura mater, arachnoid. There's a big space between the arachnoid and the pia, and it's filled with cerebrospinal fluid. Right, and we call that, what do we call that space that's deep to the arachnoid? Would you want to call that the supra? Arachnoid space, epi-arachnoid space. We want to call that the sub-arachnoid space, right? Because it's below the arachnoid membrane. And that's has filled with cerebrospinal fluid. All right, so I see a nice ventral root. I see a nice dorsal root, nice dorsal root ganglia. These little branches here, just coming off the spinal cord, we call these rootlets or little roots, but they all converge to form a root. And then notice that a dorsal root and a ventral root join together to make a spinal nerve. So here's a spinal nerve at this one location within the spinal cord, right? And it leads through that intervertebral foramen of the vertebral column. Now, what's the function of this nerve right here? Is it motor or sensory? Motor or sensory? Well, look, it has components from the ventral root and the dorsal root, so we say it is mixed. And you were right when you said, well, it has both motor and sensory. We just say mixed. Okay. And the roots are not mixed. It's either one or the other. All right, so here we see the horns of the gray matter. And, of course, here's the ventral horn, here's the dorsal horn, and then here is the lateral horn. And what are in these horns right here? Why are they gray? What's gray matter made up of? Nerve cell bodies? Yeah, nerve cell bodies and dendrites. Okay. And so here we have nerve cell bodies and dendrites of association neurons. Over here in this ventral horn, there are neurons that are going to send axons into the ventral root. And remember, those are motor. Can anybody remember the shape of a motor neuron? It was a multipolar. So the nerve cell bodies of those multipolar neurons are located here in the ventral horn, right? And then it becomes an axon. So now it's myelinated, and it leaves the spinal cord via a root. Well, first goes through these little rootlets. This lateral horn. Are part of a special kind of nervous system in our body called the autonomic nervous system, and we're going to go through a couple chapters before we get to autonomic nervous system. And nerve cell bodies for that division are located here as well. Autonomic nervous system takes care of everything inside your body except skeletal muscle. All right, so there are nerve cell bodies for that. Here are the columns, and another name for a column is a funiculus. So here's the dorsal column. Here's the lateral, and here's the ventral column, and it's white matter. So what kind of objects do we have in these different funiculi or different columns? It's white matter. What's in this area right here? White matter in the central nervous system is called a tract, right? And so, you know, two different kinds of tracts. What are two different kinds of tracts in the spinal cord? Ascending or sensory, descending, or motor. Yeah, so there are sensory or motor tracts in these different columns. Okay, so that's pretty good. A couple other things. Here is what we call the central canal, and it's filled with cerebrospinal fluid as well. It's right smack in the middle of the spinal cord. Here is that gray commissure connecting the right and left parts of the spinal cord. And I see a couple invaginations. On the dorsal side, we have the dorsal median sulcus, and here we have the ventral median fissure. Usually a fissure, I think, to be a little bit deeper than a sulcus, but that's not how the spinal cord was named. So here is the sulcus, here is the fissure. So the spinal cord almost is separated in a right and left, but not quite. All right, what else do I want to say on this figure? We've got the spinal nerve, you know, the function of a spinal nerve. All right, and so this part of the spinal cord, is this anterior or posterior part? Anterior. Yeah, this is the anterior part. And in general, if you think of the spinal cord, where is it in your body? Is it in terms of a coronal plane? Is it right smack in the middle? Is it anterior or is it more posterior? Is it obvious that it's most posterior? Think of that skeleton that we have in lab. Vertebral column is way in the back, right? Or posterior. All right, so where do you have most of your body? In front of the spinal cord or behind the spinal cord? Most of it is anterior to the spinal cord. So here I see a bifurcation of that spinal nerve. Here's one that's going posterior. Here's one that's going anterior. And so we call this a ramus. Here's the posterior ramus, here's the anterior ramus. Which one is bigger, the posterior or anterior?
Posterior.
Here's the posterior, here's the anterior. Which one is bigger? Anterior. And why is that? Because that's where most of your body is, right? It's anterior to the spinal cord. So the anterior ramus is a lot bigger compared to the posterior because you just don't have a lot of places to innervate behind the vertebral column. All right, we're going to talk about these two little things later on in a couple chapters coming up. Okay, but you got posterior or dorsal ramus. Here is the ventral or anterior ramus. Okay, I'm sure this is an exam figure, the one we just looked at. Oh, here's talking about that spinal tap. Okay, we talked about that already. All right, so the two paths in and out of the spinal cord. Talked about the gross structures. I didn't talk about cerebrospinal fluid yet. Where's that at? Ah, here it is. Okay, some more gross structures of the spinal cord. We talked about all this already. Sensory and motor pathways. Oh, and we've got to talk about some tracts. All right, let's talk about the meninges first. All right, meninges we looked at in the spinal cord, right, these layers. The most superficial is dura mater. A little bit deeper and little not quite so strong is the arachnoid. And then right on the surface of the central nervous system is the pia mater. And there's cerebrospinal fluid between the arachnoid and the pia mater in that subarachnoid space. All right, well, let's look at this in terms of the brain, because it has the same thing, and you have a really good exam figure here, which I showed you just a second ago. And here it is here. All right, so here we have a nice coronal section, right, going from left to right, and then from anterior to posterior. This would be like a sagittal section going through the brain. And let's just say we're going through the parietal bone. So here I see a parietal bone. And what's the name of a membrane right on the surface of every bone? A periosteum, right, periosteum. So here is periosteum right on top of the parietal bone. And then we have some skin on the scalp, right? And then on the inner surface of this parietal bone, we have some more periosteum, right? But now this is going to be incorporated into the meninges because it's surrounding the brain. So that periosteum is there, but it is now paired up with another membrane, which is really, really tough. If we take that periosteum, the periosteal division of the dura mater, and the meningeal division of the dura mater, put them together, then we get what? That tough membrane, the superficial membrane called the dura mater. It's got these two divisions right up against the bone. All right, and then below the dura mater, we have the arachnoid, and you can see it's a lot thinner, more delicate. And then right on the surface of the brain, you might have to use your imagination. Oh, I see it here, right? Really thin membrane, that is the pia mater. And then between the pia and arachnoid, even with some connecting fibers, some connective tissue fibers, right? That's the subarachnoid space with cerebrospinal fluid. And where do you see blood vessels? Do you see them in white matter?
No.
You see them in gray matter?
No.
You see them exterior to the brain. Here's an artery, here's a vein, right? So there are not a lot of blood vessels moving through the central nervous system like we would many other kinds of organs. They're located superficially. Right, and then fluid moves out of a capillary through the brain. And here is a big cavern, right? And we see that it's a space between, within the dura mater. We call this a sinus. And it's right on midline, so we call this the sagittal sinus. And this is acting like a vein. It's collecting blood from the brain, and it's going to deliver it eventually to the heart. Right, so even though it's not really a blood vessel, right, you should kind of think of it as a blood vessel, and in particular a vein, because it's going to be taking blood eventually back to the heart. Right, and that's what between the periosteal and meningeal layers of the dura mater. Right, the hemispheres, the right and left hemispheres, are separated by a very big fissure that goes all the way down to the corpus callosum. And we call that the longitudinal fissure. So the right side of the brain really isn't connected up to the left. And what separates it is some of that dura mater. This really tough sheet right here is called the falx cerebri. It isolates the left and right sides of the brain. Well, how does the right side of the brain know what the left is doing or thinking? How do signals get from one side of the brain to the other? A commissural tract. That's right. And one of those important places where there are commissural tracts is in the corpus callosum. And I'll show you where that is. We mentioned that earlier. Okay, but information can't go through the falx cerebri because there are no tracts in this area. All right, so that is the meninges. Okay, and let's look at some spaces inside the brain. Spaces inside the brain, Ooh, that's not it. Spaces inside the brain. Okay, so I have some spaces inside the cerebrum between the cerebellum and the pons in this area here, and even the central canal filled with cerebrospinal fluid, figure 13.9. And so anything in this nice blue color represents a space inside the brain filled with cerebrospinal fluid. So there are no neurons in this area. These spaces are lined with those ependymal cells. And these spaces are what we call ventricles. And these up over here, laterally and superiorly, these are what we call the lateral ventricles. That's nice, right? That's easy to remember because they're located laterally. So if we have a nice anterior view, we see them sticking out laterally. If it's a sagittal view, here is where they are on a sagittal view. And they have some horns, different areas, locations, right? But they used to be called ventricles 1 and 2, but now we just call them the lateral ventricles. And they share cerebrospinal fluid with the next ventricle below it. And this is the one we call the third ventricle. Right, so we still keep the number, the third ventricle right here. This is right between the lobes of the thalamus. So here is the third ventricle. The thalamus would be about in this region here and this region here. Right, and fluid can move from the lateral ventricles into the third ventricle via this interventricular foramen. What's the function of a foramen once again? In just one word, it's a passageway, right? In this particular case, it's a passageway for what? Nerves or blood vessels or what? It's for cerebrospinal fluid. Yeah, so it's a passageway for cerebrospinal fluid to go from the lateral into the third ventricle. And I can see a little bit of it here. I can see a little bit of it here as well. Okay, then here is that third ventricle between the thalamus. And what was that part of the brain that's below the thalamus? So here's the thalamus. What's that region below the thalamus? Everybody knows. I could say, for extra credit, tell me, and everybody would tell me. If this is the thalamus, this region right here is the hypothalamus, right? All right, I don't want to go over the functions because we went through that already, but even a part of the third ventricle extends between, right, the right and left hypothalamus. So sometimes we call this the wall of the hypothalamus on either side of the third ventricle. Here is a connection between the right and left lobes of the thalamus. We call this the interthalamic adhesion. Not labeled on this slide, but it's labeled on most of the other slides. And then between the pons and here's the pons and the cerebellum, here is the fourth ventricle. Doesn't really look very big on this lateral view, but it looks big on a coronal view, right, or an anterior view. So it is fairly extensive. Okay. All right, and then, so what is that tissue that makes cerebrospinal fluid? It's part ependymal cells and part capillary, joining together. So those cells take plasma from your blood. Plasma doesn't have any cells in it, no red blood cells or white blood cells, just the fluid part of blood, modifies it and puts it into these ventricles. Can anybody remember? Oh, I guess I told you, those ependymal cells. So if we put those ependymal cells together with capillaries, we get something called a choroid plexus. The choroid plexus makes cerebrospinal fluid. There's some in the third ventricle. There's a choroid plexus in the roof of the third ventricle, and there's some in the floor of the fourth ventricle. And in the lateral ventricles, that choroid plexus makes a lot of cerebrospinal fluid. So that's what pushes it into the third ventricle. Then the third ventricle adds some cerebrospinal fluid that pushes it through the cerebral aqueduct into the fourth ventricle, and then finally down into the central canal, all the way down to the tip of the spinal cord. Ooh, what was that tip of the spinal cord called? Kind of looked like a cone. Kind of looked like a cone. It was the conus medullaris. And then cerebrospinal fluid leaves through that conus medullaris, flows back up to the brain in that subarachnoid space. So there's like a special circulation around the central nervous system of that cerebrospinal fluid. Okay, now why do we have these ventricles in the brain? Well, our brains don't contain any bones, right? And that neural tissue is fairly delicate. And if we were to take you and weigh you on a scale right now, and then take you and put you in a swimming pool and weigh you in a swimming pool, how much would you weigh the same? No, because that water in the swimming pool would give you some buoyancy, right? And you would weigh a lot less. And that's the job of all this fluid inside the brain. It helps suspend this very delicate tissue so that effectively it's not so heavy, it doesn't weigh so much inside the cranium. That's one reason why it's there. Another reason why it's there is that it can distribute trauma to one part of the brain, right, to other sections of the brain so that maybe one section doesn't have to absorb all of that trauma. Right, so it helps protect the brain from impacts. That's another reason why it's there. And if you look at any helmets, for instance, football players today, it's just not a hard shell that somebody puts on to protect their head and brain. It has air chambers in there, but also fluid chambers, right? So football helmets even are modeled after the ventricles inside the brain to help absorb and distribute shock so somebody doesn't have so much brain injury when they play football. All right, so that's why the ventricles are there, as well as it adjusts the levels of electrolytes in the brain, electrolytes like sodium and potassium, and that has to do with maintaining the proper electrical properties of those neurons. So that cerebrospinal fluid is pretty important. And of course, it should never have bacteria, right, or viruses in it, ever. Okay, that is just, we looked at that one already. I want to show you the flow pattern. Okay, so here's a nice sagittal view. We've got the cerebrum. Here's the cerebellum, right? Spinal cord. What's right above the spinal cord? Medulla. Then the pons. Right, and the pons has tissue that connects it to the cerebellum. Anybody remember what that connecting tissue is, that name of that bridge that goes from the pons into the cerebellum? Yeah, peduncle. You can have a little fun with that word, peduncle. Right, and then we're up in the midbrain here. We have the superior inferior colliculus for visual reflexes and auditory reflexes. And then on the other side of the cerebral aqueduct, we have the another, what did we have here between the pons and the cerebellum? A peduncle, right? The cerebellar peduncle. Here is another peduncle, but it's not the cerebellar. This is the cerebral peduncle. Yeah, taking information up to the cerebrum and also back down. All right, and then here is the thalamus. Here's the hypothalamus. And here is that connection, major connection between the right and left side of the brain. This is what we call the corpus callosum. Right, so here is definitely some tissue. This little spur of tissue right here is what we call the fornix. We'll learn maybe some more about that in lab. And then, does this look reddish or pinkish a little bit? And reddish? All right, so this is the choroid plexus, right, in the lateral ventricle, in the third ventricle, and in the fourth ventricle. What's the job of the choroid plexus once again? Makes cerebrospinal fluid. Okay. And you see that flow pattern of cerebral spinal fluid down the central canal. There is a small hole up by the cerebellum in the fourth ventricle that lets cerebral spinal fluid out there. That's what we call an aperture. There's a median and there's some lateral apertures. And then here's that subarachnoid space. Cerebral spinal fluid flows back up, right, to the top of the brain. And then some of the arachnoid pushes up into that superior sagittal sinus. We said that was acting like a big vein, and cerebral spinal fluid then is returned to the circulatory system through this arachnoid villus. Sometimes we call this an arachnoid granulation, So villus returns cerebrospinal fluid back to the blood. But where did cerebrospinal fluid come from to begin with? It came from the blood, right? So it starts in the blood, right? Goes into cerebrospinal fluid, then it's returned to the blood because otherwise you would dehydrate if it was lost from your body. All right, so you see the flow pattern that's involved with that cerebrospinal fluid. Okay, here are some choroid plexus. You can see it's part capillary, part some of those ependymal cells. So here's pretty much a sagittal section of the brain. Here is that sagittal sinus right here that is returning blood, venous blood from the brain back to the heart, but also some cerebrospinal fluid that has entered it from that arachnoid villus. Right, and we can see that it moves down to the occipital bone, and then it joins this blood vessel right here. We call this a transverse sinus. And then the transverse sinus takes blood to the jugular vein and back to the heart. So these sinuses, I mentioned this in lab, a sinus can contain various kinds of things. Inside the brain, it contains venous blood. But for instance, in the maxilla and sphenoid bone and frontal bone, what does a sinus contain? Yeah, mucus, a mucous membrane and air. Right, so it's filled with lymphatic tissue to fight infection. So a sinus can be used to describe spaces in general. All right, here's that membrane that separates the right and left, or parts of the dura mater that separates the right and left cerebral hemispheres. We call that the falx cerebri. And then some of that membrane, some of the dura mater, separates the occipital lobe from the cerebellum, right? And we call that the falx cerebelli. Right, so falx cerebri is here, cerebelli is down over here on transverse section. So the different parts of the brain are separated from each other. One last thing I did want to show you, if I can find it quickly. Wasn't here. Not there. Okay, well, guess what? We got to finish up central nervous system next time. We're almost done. We just got to talk about some tracts. Okay, where's that sign-in sheet at?
Up front.